You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. The Venezuelan migrant crisis is one of the largest displacement crises in the world, with nearly 8 million people displaced since 2014. That's roughly 20% of the country's entire population. While regional states led by Colombia have long borne the burden of receiving migrants from Venezuela, Venezuelans are increasingly seeking refuge in the United States, where the broader migrant crisis has transformed from being an issue affecting southern border states to one that's now impacting liberal urban centers like New York City. But what's largely left out of the political discourse here in the U.S. is why people are choosing to leave Venezuela en masse and the role of U.S. policy in contributing to this great exodus. In this episode, we're going to take a deep look at the broader political and economic crisis that Venezuela has been experiencing for more than two decades and is driving the ongoing migrant crisis. We'll unpack the roots of populist authoritarianism in Venezuela and the impact of the U.S. sanctions regime. And we'll address the question of whether Venezuela can truly achieve a grand political reset at home and one with the United States, and whether this will be enough to improve the lives of ordinary Venezuelans and ease the migrant outflows into the Western Hemisphere. Our guide today is Venezuelan economist Dr. Francisco Rodriguez. He's the Rice Family Professor of the Practice of International and Public Affairs at the University of Denver's Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. Previously, Dr. Rodriguez served as head of the Economic and Financial Advisory of the Venezuelan National Assembly. Dr. Rodriguez, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Arif. Thank you for having me.
So first, I want to begin by helping our listeners contextualize the current era of Venezuelan politics. Since 1999, Venezuela has been ruled by populist socialist authoritarian leaders. Hugo Chavez assumed the presidency in 1999. He ruled until his death in 2013. And then he was succeeded by Nicolas Maduro, who remains in power. So how did this era of populist socialist authoritarianism emerge in Venezuela? And how does it fit into the country's broader history?
Well, I think it's important to start out by remembering that Venezuela did very poorly. Its economy did very poorly in the last part of the 20th century. Basically, from 1977 to 1998, it experienced negative economic growth. It was one of the worst performing economies in the region. In fact, I wrote a book together with a colleague, Ricardo Hausman, that's called Venezuela Before Chavez, Anatomy of an Economic Collapse. And it talks about that period. We've also called it the lost quarter century. Venezuela was a country that had a lot of troubles carrying out the economic reforms that many countries implemented during the 80s and 90s. It was unable to do a sensible macroeconomic stabilization. There was significant gridlock between its political parties, and oil revenues declined significantly. The country's population grew, its oil production remained relatively constant, and oil prices were quite low in the 80s, particularly from the mid-80s to the late 90s. All of that contributed to a period of economic malaise and to discontent with the parties that had traditionally ruled Venezuela during its democratic period, which had begun in 1958. So Venezuela had had continuous elections, competitive democratic elections since 1958. For the most part, two parties had alternated in power. The discontent with those parties was what opened up the space for an outsider to emerge. And that was Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez attempted a coup against a Venezuelan government, the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, in 1992. He was imprisoned. Then he came out of jail and he was immensely popular because he was seen as somebody who embodied the discontent with a system that many Venezuelans saw as corrupt. So that's what led to Chavez's election in 1998. He took power early 1999. And from the moment that he took power, he moved to centralize power in the presidency and to make the presidency a lot stronger. I personally, although there are differences in this, I would definitely refer to Hugo Chavez as a populist. I would not necessarily refer to him as an authoritarian. Now, some people would, but the reality is that Hugo Chavez won elections during the time that he was in office, repeatedly in many instances by relatively wide margins. There were some cases in which he lost elections, particularly the 2007 constitutional referendum, and the government by and large accepted or divided. It didn't try to interfere with the results of that election, even though it tried to move its reform agenda through other means. The period of increasing authoritarianism comes with Nicolas Maduro, and it comes more than anything as a result of the fact that oil revenues start declining and the government finds itself increasingly incapable of maintaining the popular support that allowed it to be successful in the polls. Now, what is true is that what Hugo Chavez did initiate, as I mentioned, was a period of concentration of power in the presidency. So to the extent that a democratic system requires not just the holding of elections, but it also requires effective separation of powers, that was very much undermined by the fact that the Chavez government was able to take control over most institutions of the state. But nevertheless, it did so according to the established rules of democracy. It did so through a constitutional referendum that was approved by an overwhelming majority of Venezuelans. So the rules of the game definitely changed in a way that, of course, favored the party that was in power at the time.
So we have the emergence of a kind of a hyper-presidency under Chavez. But there's also an ideology that one could say is leftist or socialist and populist. And could you unpack that? It seems that Maduro, and we'll get to him a bit later, inherits this mantle. But what is Chavismo?
That's a great question. And it's very hard to define. It reminds me of something that Albert Fishman said about development, which is that it's kind of like a giraffe. You don't know how to define it, but you know it when you see it. We definitely know when we see Chavismo. So Chavismo, at its core, it's very populist in the sense that it carries this message that what needs to be changed is the control that elites have over the system. A populist leader speaks directly to the people, to voters, and says, the problem is that you don't control the state. If you give me enough power, I will serve in your representation to effectively make you be able to control the state and make you take out all of those powerful elites that are controlling the state for their own ends. Now, in the case of Chavez, this mixed with leftist ideas. So definitely he was very inspired by Cuban Revolution, and he began increasingly over time, actually not at the beginning, not when he was elected into the presidency, but over time, he started adopting socialist and communist symbols. And there was a moment in which he said very clearly that he had decided that he believed in socialism and that he wanted to take the country forward through socialism. But it wasn't part of his original platform. It was something that developed much more while he was in office. And this is actually quite interesting because part of what you do see with Chavez from the moment that he gets into office is that the established elites, particularly what was left of the leadership of the parties that had been displaced from office when Chavez came in, but also business sector, the labor unions that, and it's very important to understand that in Venezuela, most labor unions that were important at the moment at which Chavez came into office were essentially public sector labor unions. So they were very much part of the machinery of these political parties, Democratic Action and COPE, that had dominated Venezuelan politics. The media actually was also extremely important. There was essentially a media oligopoly of economic groups that were very much opposed to Chavez. And they coalesced around an attempt to oust Chavez from power in 2001 through a coup, and then in 2002 through an oil strike, because these groups also control the management of the country's oil company, even though the company was state-owned. So that period in which the existing vested interests tried to drive Chavez from power, tried to oust him from power, was very important in fueling the radical leftist ideology. I would think that before 2001, in Chavismo, there were different competing groups, and there were leftists, but there were also centrists, and there were even people on the right. It was much more of a diffuse populist set of ideals. In
after the coup, after the oil strike, then the idea that this is predominantly about class conflict and that the rich and the oligarchs who were trying to displace Chavez and Chavismo from power really takes hold, I think, in Chavez's mind and in the minds, of course, of his followers. And that's when the movement starts becoming much more explicitly leftist.
Mm. And so, you know, Venezuela is said to be one of the world's most unequal societies. And I'm wondering to what extent that played a role in terms of creating the foundation for the emergence of Hugo Chavez as a political actor and this sort of broader ideology or style of Chavismo. And then I'm also wondering, you know, when we look at the type of cycles we've seen in Venezuela, there's a lot of parallel with developments in other parts of the world. The trend towards nationalization in the 1970s, and then the IMF mandated structural adjustment in the 1980s, and the discontent and negative externalities that emerge from that. So I'm wondering, in terms of the emergence of Chavismo, to what extent is it a reaction to one externally mandated economic quote-unquote reforms, and also longstanding inequalities in Venezuelan society?
Yes. I mean, I think that both are true. Well, inequality data in Latin America, particularly when we go back to the 90s, is kind of spotty. So it's difficult to make a decisive assertion as to whether Venezuela is highly unequal or not in the Latin American context, but it probably was one of the most unequal countries in Latin America. And in any case, Latin America is a very unequal region. And at the time, it was and still is the most unequal region in the world. So definitely inequality fueled the discontent with the existing system. And there are two events I think that here are important in terms of highlighting what led to the rise of Chavismo. One of them was the structural adjustment package implemented in 1989 by the administration of Carlos Andrés Pérez. Pérez had been president during the first oil boom. He had actually ran the country during his first administration much more like a leftist populist. But then he was elected for a second administration 10 years later, after being 10 years out of office in 1989. And at that moment, the government was essentially broke, and he called for support of the IMF, multilateral institutions. It was the time of the Washington Consensus, and they implemented a very strict austerity program. And that austerity program was highly contractionary. You had a burst of inflation with price liberalization, and you had a significant contraction of the economy. And particularly at the moment at which it started to be implemented, one of the first things that the government did was that it raised gasoline prices. And this had an effect on transportation prices in Caracas. And this was just right after Pérez had been inaugurated. And it led to huge riots in Caracas, in which people were protesting the increase in gasoline. They were also protesting not just the gas hikes, but they were protesting the fact that the government was not even attempting to enforce the new public transportation prices, but had actually let the transportation companies essentially set the price according to market rules, or according to not very well understood rules at the time. So there was a lot of disarray. This led to protests, riots, and the government reacted very violently. And in fact, it brought out the army to implement essentially what had been designed as a reaction to a guerrilla insurgency. So it dealt with popular protests as if they were a guerrilla insurgency. There are different estimates of the numbers of deaths on that day, which was February 27 of 1989. But I would say the most credible estimates are of around 2,000 to 3,000 deaths. And this led to huge disenchantment with the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez. And it also was one of the main inspirations for young people in the military led by Hugo Chavez to stage what would then become the 1992 coup attempt. So definitely in the ideology, in the genesis of this movement, you know, many of them were young soldiers who were essentially taken to the city, to Caracas, many times as happens in these counterinsurgency plans. They would move the soldiers from the province to the city because the soldiers would be more likely to be willing to repress demonstrations or rioting in a place that where they're not a native of, and therefore they had no family and didn't know the people who were protesting. And this led to a huge reaction within the rank and file of the military, who felt that they were being used to turn their guns on Venezuelans who were protesting because they were hungry. So definitely that had a very significant effect. I would also point to another event, which was the 1994 banking crisis, in which the Venezuelan government spent billions of dollars trying to rescue Venezuelan banks. And many of the banks that failed, depositors lost their money. Many of these bankers actually ended up as fugitives from justice. They ended up leaving the country. The rescue package to try to save these banks, which ultimately went under, generated huge levels of inflation in Venezuela. So there was, again, the sense among many Venezuelans that the system was biased against them. It was biased against poor people, and it was being exploited by the rich. And that's what set the stage for somebody like Chavez to emerge with a very much redistributive message.
And so he comes to power in 1999 after the 1998 elections, and he rules until his death in 2013. It's a tumultuous period, and as you said, there's also an attempt to remove him from power in 2002, briefly succeeded. Now, Chavez pushed forward many policies that were ostensibly pro-poor, including a national literacy program, a universal healthcare program, and subsidized food programs. But we still see inequality persist in Venezuela. And maybe that's a problematic issue because of questionable data or the absence of data that comes out of Venezuela. But I'm wondering, in your view, how has the average Venezuelan fared under Chavismo?
No, I mean, the average Venezuelan fared very well during Chavez's time in power. Now, whether that's due to Chavez's policies or not is quite questionable, because when Chavez was elected, Venezuelan oil was selling at a price of $8 a barrel. And when Chavez died, it was selling at $103 a barrel. The Venezuelan state had a lot more money during the period of Chavez's time in office. Chavez definitely spent some of that money in doing things that were good for the poor. And I would point to a program of health clinics called Barrio Adentro inside the shantytown, inside the favela, which set up health clinics, many of them housed actually with Cuban vouchers that were accessible to Venezuelans in a way in which healthcare had not been accessible to them previously. And in terms of the food program, which was the launch of the system of food markets, Mercal, for Mercado de Alimentos, was actually quite interesting because the government, rather than subsidize the private sector so that the private sector would offer low prices, it got directly into food distribution, and it directly set up food markets that targeted low-income communities because they were located in low-income communities, in order to sell subsidized food products. Those programs, I think, had a significant effect. There were other programs whose effects is more questionable. I think that the literacy program is a program that I studied, and there's not that much evidence of its effectiveness. But I do think that the food subsidies and the healthcare program helped. Now, that said, it was the period during which the government had a lot of money. So the government was spending money on these programs. It was also spending money in just creating a bigger state. And it was spending money in doing something that I think is very problematic, which is in propping up the exchange rate, maintaining an overvalued exchange rate. Now, why did it do this? Well, it turns out that in Venezuela, and let me first explain what that is. Maintaining an overvalued exchange rate basically means when the government receives dollars, it sells them directly in the foreign exchange market so as to lower the price of dollars and therefore lower the price of imported goods. Now, this is very popular because it allows people to have access to cheap imported goods. The thing is that it's not very redistributive because those who will be able to buy more dollars will tend to be those who are richer. It's actually a way in which you redistribute resources to the upper middle class. And it's something that Venezuelan governments had done in the past, and the Chavez administration continued doing despite its leftist rhetoric. So when one tries to assess whether the government was good for the poor or not, you have to take into account, first of all of the money that it had. And yes, I mean, it was good for the poor for the government to have all of that money. Now, was the government very much pro-poor in its spending? I'm not so sure that you can make that assessment, but I think it's primarily because it was also full of contradictions. There were attempts to increase social spending on some dimensions. And on the other hand, the government felt that it was necessary to maintain this huge subsidy to imported goods that ended up favoring the upper middle and upper classes.
Mm. So Venezuela has seen these kind of boom bust cycles that are associated with the price of oil. And when times are good in terms of the oil market, those positive feedbacks flow back to the average person. But when there's a downturn in the oil market and there's a glut in terms of supply, then these kind of imbalances emerge and the Venezuelan economy goes under stress. Now, when we look at the question of Chavez and the opposition to him, it seems like in terms of the state-owned oil company, he took some measures to root out many of its or fire many of its employees. And that has also had devastating effect on the efficiency and the operations of that company. Was that in response to the elites that had consolidated power in critical state organizations? Or what was behind that?
Well, there was a struggle for control of the oil company. And in that sense, what happened at the beginning of the Chavez period in 2001 and 2002 with the coup attempt and the oil strike is not that different from what's happened more recently during the period of sanctions and maximum pressure. Because part of what the opposition leadership tried to do was to oust Chavez from power by paralyzing the country's oil industry. Yes, it's true that Chavez fired tens of thousands, around 20,000 employees of the state-owned oil company, but it's also important to understand in what context that happened. It wasn't that Chavez woke up one day and he said, I'm going to fire half of the employees of the oil company. It was that in Venezuela's, as Venezuela's political crisis deteriorated, first, there was a coup attempt against Chavez in April of 2002. Chavez survived that coup attempt. And then the opposition in December of 2002 called for an oil strike. At the moment of the oil strike, which was intended to paralyze the country's economy, and this is a country that 95% of its export revenue comes from oil. So if you paralyze the country's oil industry, you're throwing the economy into havoc. That's the moment where Chavez says, well, those who participate in the strike are fired. Those who are trying to overthrow the government by abusing their control over the industry that forms the basis of our economy can no longer continue to work. So I think that what we have is an episode where political conflict, the conflict over who is in power, ends up spilling over into the economy. And as Chavismo and the opposition were fighting for control of the state-owned oil company, this led to huge losses. It led to tens of thousands of the state-owned company's workers being fired. Now, did this have a significant effect on the long-run effect on the productivity of the oil company? Is less clear. We know that today in the 2023 and in the 2020s, Venezuela's state-owned oil company is in shambles. But we're talking about something that happened 20 years ago. And what you actually see in the data is that when the oil strike occurs and when those who participate in the oil strike are fired from the company, then there is a decline in which oil production essentially goes to zero during a period of several weeks. Then oil company workers who were loyal to the government start taking control of the operations, and oil production recovers basically to the pre-strike levels, a little bit below the pre-strike levels. So yes, I mean, Venezuelan oil production ended up being lower than before the strike, but not that much. It's about 10% lower. And it's not even clear whether that decline was caused by the firing of the employees or by all of the other effects that it has on the company being shut down for a period of 2 months because of the strike. Nevertheless, what we do see after that is that Venezuelan oil production pretty much stabilizes at around 2.5 million barrels per day. I do think that there were a lot of problems in the government and management of the oil industry. And I think that, but I think that they had a lot more to do, not so much with the employees that were fired and those who continued in the firm. I mean, I think that in the end, there was sufficient expertise to run the firm, also among government loyalists, and they demonstrated that by recovering oil production relatively rapidly. I think that would happen with something else, which is that as the government started trying to increase social spending, but also maintain this overvalued exchange rate. And let me again spend a minute discussing what that means. If you're in a country where the government owns the main producer of foreign exchange, which is the state-owned oil company, and you try to maintain the price of foreign exchange low, because that's the way in which you make cheap imports available for everybody and for the middle class and the upper middle class, then what you're doing is that you're hurting the state's revenues, because those dollars that you're selling cheap are the dollars that are coming into the state-owned oil company, PDVSA. So PDVSA was under a lot of pressure during the Chavez period. And despite the fact that oil prices were very low, firm wasn't really profitable. It was profitable, but maintaining that overvalued exchange rate forced it to, was a way in which it transferred its surplus to the buyers of imports in the economy. So before that transfer of surplus, it was profitable. After the transfer of surplus, it wasn't. And therefore, it didn't really have the capacity to invest in increasing oil output. That I think was the main problem, was the lack of investment to increase oil output. They invested enough so as to maintain oil output. I mean, they weren't going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. But if you look at this period of time, other oil producing countries in the world, when oil prices had significantly increased, were ramping up production. Venezuela should have done that. Venezuela is sitting on the world's largest oil reserves. It didn't do that because Chavez's fiscal model put too much stress on PDVSA, the state-owned oil company, as a generator of revenues.
So propping up the currency was a regressive measure that helped the middle class or the upper middle class, those with more income, and also denied, took away resources or revenue from the government to invest in improving the efficiency of the state-owned oil company, right?
That's right, yes.
And so Chavez continues in power until his death in 2013. Maduro takes over then. To what extent does the Maduro era reflect a continuation of Chavismo, of the Chavez style of politics, both in terms of economic policy and in terms of power? Or does he take the country into a real different direction?
Well, that's a great question. It's a radically different time, because what happens to Maduro is that just as he comes into office, oil revenues start declining. And there are two things that happen. One of them is that Chavez had been reelected in 2012 for a third term. And Chavez was ill at the time at which he was reelected. He had been diagnosed with cancer. And it was really important for the government. I mean, when he decided to run, it was really important to make sure that that was a decisive victory. And Chavez saw it as a way of ensuring the continuation of the revolution. So Chavez won by a pretty decisive margin and 11-point difference against his adversary, Enrique Capriles. And soon after that, he dies, and there's a snap election that's called, in which Maduro, who had been directly designated by Chavez as his successor, is elected to complete Chavez's term, but wins by a much smaller margin, 1.5 percentage points. And part of what had happened is that Chavez had spent a lot of money ensuring his reelection, and the country had run a huge current account deficit in the year in 2012, in the year of re-election. So Maduro slams on the brakes. I mean, he has to. He has no option. The government couldn't keep on spending at that level. And when he slams on the brakes, that by itself, which he does it at the beginning of 2013, that by itself almost cost him the election. So when Maduro is in office during his first years, he's kind of facing this problem, which is that the Venezuelan government and Chavez had maintained this, not only an illusion of prosperity, but also he had been able to maintain some level of social cohesion by keeping the exchange rate propped up. I mean, there's a reason why Chavez faced political conflict at the beginning of his time in office, but didn't face that level of political conflict after he had been in office for 10 more years. And it's that, yes, oil prices were higher, but also by maintaining the exchange rate overvalued, Chavez was able to keep relatively content the middle class, the upper middle classes, these sectors which would have, and in other circumstances, really fueled the opposition to him. Maduro is no longer able to do that because he just doesn't have the oil revenues to do it. So what he does is that he starts rationing foreign exchange. So instead of devaluing the currency, which is what economic theory recommends you should do at that moment, he actually starts rationing access to foreign exchange. He starts rationing access to goods. So he imposes very strict price controls, which had not been seen during the Chavez administration. There had been price controls, but they had been relatively moderate because the government could keep prices down by selling dollars. Maduro was not able to do that. And that in itself creates havoc in the economy. So you have an economy, and we have to remember the collapse in oil prices was really huge. I mean, at the beginning of Maduro's time in office, he was just slamming the brakes because he couldn't keep on spending as much as Chavez did. But then oil prices went from $100 a barrel at the beginning of 2014 to less than $30 a barrel at the beginning of 2016. So this is the government income dropping by 70%. And that's when the Venezuelan economy starts going into double-digit contraction. And that's when the country starts going into hyperinflation. So Maduro's policies were very statist at that moment, at the beginning, particularly in terms of the enforcement of price controls. But these price controls weren't really very effective because the government didn't really have the capacity to implement them and to enforce them, given particularly the extent of the distortion between the prices that he wanted to enforce. He essentially refused to devalue the currency, even though you were having double and triple digit inflation. And this created huge distortions in the economy. But then we have another period in which the U.S. starts imposing sanctions in 2017, first financial sanctions, which are aimed to cut the country off from access to the international financial system, and particularly to international lending, and then oil sanctions in 2019, which cut off the government's access to revenues from its oil sales. And there we see an interesting turn in Maduro's policies, which is that they actually become somewhat less statist. They become, I mean, I wouldn't call them free market, but they start making somewhat more sense. The government ultimately lets go of the exchange rate and unifies the exchange rate. The government that was trying to maintain these subsidies through the sale of very cheap, artificially cheap goods through government-owned supermarkets, many of those goods were actually ending up in Colombia because the incentive to contraband them was just so high. The government shifted to a system of direct distribution of food boxes to low-income families. So the nature of the policy starts changing, and what we end up seeing, we do see an increasingly authoritarian government. But when you go to Venezuela, It looks nothing like a socialist economy nowadays. It's basically a free market economy. In fact, I would say it's almost Chavez was the one who coined the term, at least in Latin America, of savage capitalism. And Venezuela today almost looks like the savage capitalism that Chavez built his political career on criticizing.
Mm. So we have an unraveling of the kind of political settlement or social contract that existed under Chavez because of the decline in the price of oil, and then later the U.S. sanctions. And so Maduro appears to rely more on authoritarian measures to maintain his hold on power. And then he presides over an election in 2018 that is widely regarded as unfree and manipulated. So I want you to unpack the changes that are happening politically as well under Maduro, and how that has and the measures he's taken to kind of consolidate power and maintain his grip on power despite being increasingly unpopular.
Right. So I think that the really important turning point here is the 2015 parliamentary elections, and these were the first elections for government officials that the government lost. I mean, the government had lost a constitutional referendum in 2007, but it had never lost an election either at the regional, in terms of national level results. Whenever there were gubernatorial elections, the government had won the majority, as well as in presidential elections, as well as in a recall referendum, because in 2004, finally, the opposition managed to hold a recall referendum against Chavez, and Chavez won that referendum pretty handily by almost 20 points. But in 2015 is the first time that the opposition gains control of Congress through what was actually a massive victory. The opposition wins with a comfortable margin of around 10 points, but because of the way in which Venezuelan districts are drawn up and because most legislators are elected in first-past-the-post districts, then the opposition was able to gain a two-thirds control of the National Assembly, which is the Venezuelan unicameral legislature in 2015. Now, it's important to understand something. Chavez, as I mentioned earlier, had in 1999 approved a new constitution that had made the Venezuelan presidency all powerful. But there's another institution that was also made all powerful in the 1999 constitution, which was the National Assembly, or to be more precise, a supermajority, a two-thirds supermajority of the National Assembly. So the two-thirds supermajority of the National Assembly, which was the opposition, was able to win in 2015, actually had the authority to initiate a trial against the president and had the authority to appoint Supreme Court justices and to appoint a prosecutor general. So it ultimately had the authority to even get rid of the president. So you basically ended up setting up this clash of powers between an all-powerful presidency and all-powerful legislature, at least constitutionally. And that's where it becomes clear from day one that instead of trying to resolve this issue, then by negotiation, what the sides, that is Chavismo and the opposition, or Maduro and the opposition, end up doing is ramping up conflict. This happens in parliamentary systems. Well, in presidentialist systems, actually, sorry. It happens a lot of times. And in the U.S., you have divided government, and sometimes the party that's not in government wins the control of Congress, and the chief executive has to live with it. In France, which is another presidentialist system, you also have, and they're referred to as cohabitation governments. But cohabitation did not emerge in Venezuela. What emerged was an all-out conflict. The opposition decided from day one, from the day in which the new president of the National Assembly was sworn in for the first term under the opposition control, he stated that his main objective was to design a roadmap so that there could be a change in government within the next 6 months. And of course, the government responded in kind. And what ended up happening in this conflict is that it was up to the Supreme Court to decide in the conflict between the government and the opposition. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the government. And not surprisingly, I mean, this Supreme Court was made up of Supreme Court justices that had been appointed over the course of the previous 12 years by Chavez or by constitutional rules, but during a period in which Chavismo controlled the presidency and controlled the National Assembly. So it's not surprising that the Supreme Court was overwhelmingly Chavista, and the Supreme Court sided with Maduro. So what ended up happening there is that there was a moment in which the Supreme Court, in response to allegations of fraud in the election of three legislators, the Supreme Court, or the Electoral Court, actually, which is the chamber of the Supreme Court, suspended the election of those legislators from the state of Amazonas. And that suspension actually made the opposition fall just below the two-thirds majority. So they would have still had a majority, but they wouldn't have had that all-powerful two-thirds supermajority. And that's where the opposition said, no, we're not going to take it. We're not going to accept that the Supreme Court suspend the election of these legislators. These legislators are going to continue to be part of Congress. So the Supreme Court reacts by saying, well, if you insist that those legislators that we have removed via court order will continue to session and vote in Congress, we have no way of impeding you from doing it, but we are going to hold Congress in contempt of court decisions until this matter is resolved. So at the end, what ends up happening is that as a result of this lack of ability to form a cohabitation agreement, then what ended up happening is that the Supreme Court essentially overruled the powers of Congress, and Congress ended up being completely and effectively powerless during this period. So then that leads us to the issue of elections, and particularly the electoral boycott of 2018. And I think it's really important as you said, that boycott, that election is typically characterized as being rigged. And it's actually not always clear why that characterization is assumed, or exactly what is the explanation, or in what does the rigging of that election actually consist. I mean, if you hear the many descriptions of the 2018 election, you would imagine Maduro basically cooked up the results in the presidential palace. There's pretty strong evidence that that was not the case. But really what happened with the 2018 elections was not that the results were altered. The opposition did not win that election. The opposition boycotted that election. Why did the opposition boycott that election? It basically boycotted the election because the candidates, there were two candidates who many people in the opposition wanted to be the opposition candidates, particularly Enrique Capriles and, more importantly, Leopoldo López, who were banned from running for office at that moment. And they were banned because of a decision. Decisions of other branches of Venezuelan government, either the judiciary or the accountability branch, that basically ruled that they were ineligible. Now, I want to just make an important point here, which is that the banning of political candidates, I think it's a very bad practice. I don't like it. And I think that it undermines democracy. But in Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was banned from running for the presidency because of a corruption case, which is pretty much recognized nowadays, both by Brazilian institutions, by the Brazilian Supreme Court, as well as by the United Nations, as being essentially a case that was completely politicized and trumped up. So the banning of political, and even in the U.S., there is right now a discussion, for example, as to whether former President Donald Trump should be able to run for office or not. And there are people who hold diverse views on that. So it's not the banning of some candidates from running for office is that unusual. There are, in many political systems, there are laws and there are rules that establish if somebody has been condemned for a crime, for a certain type of crime, they are not able to hold elected office. And in fact, that is what happened with Leopoldo López. Whether the trial that led to his indictment, in which He was accused of leading protests that ended in the actual burning of the building of the prosecutor general's office back in 2014. I think that, you know, we would probably all agree that, you know, burning down the public prosecutor's office is not the way in which you conduct a peaceful democratic debate. Now, there's a much deeper question, of course, of whether that trial was just and whether he was. But to my point, I mean, these are exactly the same type of questions that were raised about the trial of Lula. And while I do think that these bans ultimately undermine democracy, it's, you know, I've never heard of Brazilian elections during the time that Lula was banned from running for election as being rigged because he was not able to run. So there's really a lot of things that have to be taken with a grain of salt there. But there's also something really important when you tell the history of what happened in Venezuela in 2018, which is that you have to go back to October 2017. Because October 2017 is the moment at which gubernatorial elections are held in Venezuela. Now, remember that in 2015, the opposition had won massively the National Assembly, and the economy was in shambles. So what would you expect to have happened when they held gubernatorial elections? You would have expected the opposition to sweep. What happened in those elections? The contrary. The government won, and the government won by a pretty sizable margin. The government won an overwhelming majority of governorships. So what happened between 2015 and 2017? Well, it's not altogether clear, but what seems to have happened is that most opposition followers essentially lost faith in their leadership. So what you see is not so much that Chavismo got more votes than what it had gotten in 2015, is that the opposition got less votes. So a lot of opposition voters stayed home. And this is something that strikes huge fear into the opposition leadership. When the opposition leadership says, well, what if we lose the 2018 presidential elections? We were supposed to win. We thought that we were going to win but we just lost a major national election where Chavismo has taken most governorships. So that's when the opposition decides that it's going to go for the boycott of the 2018 elections. And the 2018 elections were not contested. I mean, they were not contested by the traditional opposition. That's basically what happened. So it's a much more complex story. And by the way, I mean, I think that there's a lot of undemocratic undoes of the Maduro government. But the story is a lot more complex because the problem is that there's a lot of undemocratic conducts of the Venezuelan opposition too.
Yeah. So it becomes somewhat of a zero-sum game between the government and the opposition. And then there's also an institutional breakdown in terms of, you know, governmental institutions that are supposed to restrain the power of the elected government. Now, the U.S. government, and in particular the Trump administration, responds with very severe economic sanctions on the Maduro government, banning the import of Venezuelan oil and barring the oil industry from accessing financing in the U.S. And in your view, as a political economist, what has been the net effect of these sanctions? Have they been effective, or have they punished Venezuelans more than the regime itself?
Okay, so there are two different questions here. One of them is whether they have been effective in terms of their aim, which is generating regime change or generating a return to democracy in Venezuela. And I think that the answer there is it doesn't appear to be the case. I mean, certainly they have not achieved their objectives. Now, of course, establishing causality in social sciences is extremely difficult. So you can make the argument that, and some people make the argument that yes, Maduro is still in power, but the opposition is stronger than it would be without the sanctions. That is, that the sanctions give the opposition leverage, and that the only reason that Maduro is negotiating is because of the sanctions. So that argument has been made. But let's say that what we do know is true is that the sanctions were imposed and we did not get regime change in Venezuela. So And this is not what those who were opposing the sanctions believed was going to be the case. So John Bolton, who was national security advisor to President Donald Trump at the time of the imposition of oil sanctions, quotes himself is in the discussion of the adoption of sanctions as saying, well, why don't we go for a win here? So the idea was that if you impose this maximum pressure, it would lead to Maduro's ouster from power. It did not, clearly. And not only that, Maduro is, I think, right now in a much stronger position in terms of his control and power than he was back in 2017 when these sanctions started being imposed. So in my view, sanctions have not contributed positively towards bringing Venezuela to democracy. And there are several reasons why this has not been the case. And one of them is that the sanctions are a very blunt instrument. And it's interesting to try to think through what you're trying to do when you impose sanctions. So what is it that the Trump administration was trying to do? Some people have characterized sanctions as, you know, making life difficult for authoritarian leaders. Well, yes, life becomes more difficult running a sanctioned economy than if you were running a non-sanctioned economy. There's a logic to that argument. But the decision, if what you're trying to do is to pressure the authoritarian leader into leaving, into resigning, into opening up to democracy, then that decision is going to be based on the comparison that the leader makes between his situation if they concede to the sanctions and situation if they resist the sanctions. And of course, when you have the level of political polarization that you have in Venezuela, and when you have something that becomes a very prominent in U.S. and opposition discourse, which is the very firm and strong characterization of the Maduro regime as a criminal regime. Now, we can discuss whether that's true or not, but here I'm trying to go one step back and analyze what are the effects of that characterization on the effectiveness of sanctions. Well, it turns out that if, as happened during the Trump administration, you indict Maduro, the U.S. Justice Department indicted Maduro, charging him with conspiring to flood the U.S. market with drugs, and it issued a $15 million bounty on his head. The signal that this is sending to Maduro is not, if you give up power, then you can live the rest of your life in retirement. It's if you give up power, then you're going to spend the rest of your life in a U.S. jail. So the incentives are wrong. I mean, if you're thinking of this as a strategic tool to try to force Maduro from power, yes, it might be making life more difficult for him in power, but you're certainly signaling that you're making that his life is going to be impossible outside. So other people say, well, the logic of sanctions is not really to convince Maduro, it's to convince the military, right? So what they were trying to do was to convince the military to turn on Maduro. And there again, yes, I mean that. So there, you can try to use sanctions selectively by targeting some military leaders and not others, and sending the signal to those others if they do not side with Maduro, if they turn against Maduro, then sanctions won't be imposed on them. But really, this is like trying to micromanage the Venezuelan military from an office in the U.S. Treasury Department in Washington, D.C. It's just absurd, and it didn't work. So in effect, what happened is that the military rallied around Maduro, and Maduro had his hold on power consolidated. So in that sense, I think it's clear that the sanctions did not help produce regime change. Even if you measure and going for a moment to the recent agreements that were signed in Barbados between the government and the opposition, there's something actually quite interesting, and we can talk more about that later. But what's interesting is that the opposition actually accepted a deal in the agreements that were signed just a couple of months ago, it accepted a deal which was exactly like the deal that it had turned down in 2018. So when the opposition decided that it wasn't going to go to the elections, that it was going to boycott the 2018 elections, it turned down a deal where the government actually offered them two electoral council members, international observers, and the same electoral conditions of the elections that the opposition had won massively in 2015. And the opposition turned it down. Why did it turn it down? Well, there's a lot of speculation as to that. I think that most people who are close to that decision believe that it was because the U.S. government told the opposition to turn it down. The U.S. government told them, look, you don't have to reach a deal with Maduro. We're going to get rid of Maduro through maximum pressure. You don't have, if you sign this deal, then even if you win the elections, you're going to have to live with Maduro. And there's a chance that you could lose the elections. As I said, the opposition had just lost a major election. I mean, why put up with that if we can get rid of Maduro through maximum pressure? But that same deal that the opposition turned down in 2018, now it accepted it in 2023. And that's a very strong sign that the opposition is in a weaker position right now. It has much less bargaining power than before the sanctions started. Then there's the other question, which is not one of effective, but one of effect. That is, how do sanctions affect regular Venezuelans? How do they affect the average Venezuelan on the street? And I think that here the evidence is very clear that sanctions have significantly affected the country's oil industry. When you look at Venezuelan oil production, it's very clear that it starts declining, and it sees several inflection points at the moment at which sanctions are imposed. I've done a lot of work on this, trying to disentangle and test different theories for the decline of the Venezuelan oil industry. And let me summarize them by the following. In my work, in my empirical estimates, I estimate that approximately half of Venezuela's 72% contraction in per capita income is attributable to sanctions and other foreign policy measures of the United States that sought to circumscribe the economic capacity of the Maduro government. So, in other words, when you look at Venezuela's crisis, you can attribute around half of it to what the U.S. tried to do to drive Maduro from power. Most of this operated, although not all of it, through harming the country's oil industry. And in that sense, it has a very similar pattern to what the opposition tried to do in 2002 when it called the oil company strike. It's almost that there's almost a way to tell the story where the opposition tried to drive Chavez from power by shutting down the oil industry. Chavez reasserted control. Chavez took control of the oil industry. And then the opposition moved its strategy so as to, because it no longer controlled the oil industry, so as to try to overthrow Maduro by cutting the Venezuelan oil industry from its capacity to sell oil internationally and therefore undermining it. And that was very effective at arming the Venezuelan oil industry and therefore at harming the Venezuelan economy.
So, you know, using the oil national oil company as a political tool, as a means to influence the change of government, has had pretty disastrous effects for the economy, with inflation rising by some estimates to upwards of 80,000%. I mean, these are astronomical figures. Could you talk a bit more about the economic impact of the sanctions on the average Venezuelan, and to what extent this hyperinflation is the result of the sanctions, and how it's impacted the daily life for Venezuelans?
Yes. So, well, the Venezuelan economy runs on oil. 95% of the country's external revenue comes from oil. So if you stop this economy from producing oil, then the economy essentially has nothing else to sell to the rest. So it's not surprising. So Venezuela's economic contraction is the largest documented economic contraction observed outside of wartime in world history. So it's really major. This is the equivalent of three Great Depressions. And as I said, in my estimates, around half of that is due to sanctions and other foreign policy measures of the U.S. Now, one way to think about this is countries like Venezuela, that particularly if they're poorly managed, they tend to experience economic crises. And usually what happens is that you'll have these, what Rüdiger Dornbusch and Sebastian Edwards, two prominent macroeconomists, characterize as populist macroeconomic cycles, where you'll have a period of expansion as you had in Venezuela during Chavez's time in office. And then the prices of what the country sells to the rest of the world will decline. And then the country will enter into balance of payments and exchange rate and fiscal crisis. And you'll see an economic contraction. You'll see inflation go up. You'll see all the things that you saw happening in Venezuela before sanctions. Now, that type of contractions can be quite large. And Venezuela had seen them before. But quite large means 20, 30, 35% of GDP. It's not 70% of GDP. I think that in the absence of sanctions, we would have seen that type of contraction. We would have seen a major economic crisis in Venezuela, like the crisis that many Latin American countries went through in the 1980s, that led the 1980s to be characterized as the region's lost decade. But we would not have seen the massive disappearance of income and wealth that we have seen in this period. The main effect of sanctions is through oil revenues, just because this is what the economy runs on. Now, there is evidence that there are effects that go beyond oil revenues and that they have to do with the fact that the economy has become essentially toxic, so that there's been a 93% decline in correspondent bank activity. So in the number of international banks that are willing to do business with Venezuelan banks. And this is interesting because the Venezuelan banks that I'm referring to are not part of the Venezuelan state. They are actually private sector banks. But it's still the case that international banks say, I don't want to deal with you because you're in a sanctioned country. You're in a country run by a sanctioned government. Well, this has significant effects on the private sector economy. There is plenty of evidence and hundreds of anecdotes coming from the humanitarian sector that state that essentially humanitarian aid agencies have had significant trouble and significant difficulties carrying out one of basic operations because of a problem that's often characterized as overcompliance. That in itself is a bit of a misnomer, but it's essentially banks becoming overly cautious with respect to dealing with Venezuela because of the sanctions regime. So all of these effects have taken place, but the main effect has been through this massive economic contraction that was caused by the decline in oil prices. And when GDP goes down by more than 70%, then and when the state is left without resources because the sanctions were aimed at state revenues, then obviously you're going to enter into fiscal crisis. And obviously this is going to fuel hyperinflation. Now, would Venezuela have gone into a hyperinflation without the sanctions? It's not clear. I mean, it's not always easy to answer that type of counterfactual questions. But what we do know is that in 2017 is when we start seeing oil production declining, and it declines after sanctions are imposed, and then it declines more strongly in 2019. After 2017 is with financial sanctions, 2019 is with oil sanctions, and 2020 is with secondary sanctions on a foreign non-US partner, so of the Venezuelan state-owned oil company. And all of those have clearly identifiable effects on the oil production series. So what that means is that if Venezuela, and just a bit to fix ideas, if oil production had stayed at the pre-sanctions level, then in 2018, Venezuela would have had $15 billion more dollars in foreign exchange revenue than what it actually had. And if the Venezuelan state had that, then it would have been able to import many more goods, many more essential goods. It would have been able to actually fund government spending without having to print so much money as it did. So it's either the case that Venezuela could have avoided hyperinflation, or even if not, most likely it would have been a much shorter episode of hyperinflation than what it was. Venezuela's hyperinflation actually ended up being the third longest hyperinflation in world history. And that's because the government had no revenue. And it's important to bear in mind that this is usually what hyperinflations are. Hyperinflations occur. So the classic hyperinflation was the one that occurred in the 1920s in Weimar Germany. And when did it occur? It occurred when the Germans were unable to make reparations payments to the Allies, and Belgium and France decided to occupy the Ruhr areas, which were the areas that produced most of the foreign exchange revenue of Germany. That's when the economy went into a tailspin, and that's when the government had no option but to continue printing money. So it's not surprising that if you target an economy's capacity to generate a foreign revenue, you're going to end up with a hyperinflation.
Mm. So one could argue that the imposition of these sanctions deepened an economic downturn that had occurred in part because of, largely in part of, because of the decline in oil prices. And so it just exacerbated a downward trend and made it a bit deeper, much deeper. Now, when we look at, you know, Venezuela seems to be a country that produces these astronomical figures in terms of inflation, the deep depth of its economic downturn, and then also in terms of the external outflows of peoples. So there are nearly 8 million Venezuelans who've essentially voted with their feet since 2014 and left the country. And this is one of the largest mass exoduses that the world has seen in recent years. So I'm wondering, and you know, we have now this issue is coming to the doorsteps of Americans because of the broader migrant crisis, that the Venezuelans are increasingly, you know, becoming part of that pool of individuals who are coming through that southern border. And it's becoming not just an issue that is impacting, you know, southern border states, but because of U.S. politics, and now it's impacting urban centers where these migrants are being bussed over to. So I'm wondering, do you see this migrant crisis, at least in terms of the Venezuelan factor, as a potential, could it be argued that it's a blowback from U.S. policy towards Venezuela over the past decade or so? Is it a result? To what extent is it a result of U.S. sanctions towards Venezuela?
If you look at the economic forecast put out by the private sector, by industry analysts, and by forecasting agencies at the beginning of 2017, before the U.S. Imposed sanctions, which, by the way, sanctions, economic sanctions, were not really expected by most people, until Trump came into office and until people actually figured out that Trump really did want to pursue a very hawkish line with respect to Venezuela and Cuba. The Obama administration had put in personal sanctions. But through all of this period of governance crisis in Venezuela, Europe has imposed only personal sanctions. And Europe has been very clear in stating that they will not consider imposing sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector, because that will just increase difficulties for Venezuelans. So the U.S. is the only country that imposed economic sanctions on Venezuela. It just so happens that U.S. economic sanctions are very powerful, particularly when the U.S. decides that not only is it going to use those sanctions to stop Venezuela from trading with the U.S., but it's also going to use them through what are known as secondary sanctions, which is threatening other countries that if they trade with Venezuela, they could also end up being sanctioned. So it's interesting that before the U.S. took this decision, before it became clear that the U.S. was leaning in this direction, you actually had most economic forecasters forecasting economic recovery in Venezuela in 2017 and 2018. You had oil sector forecasters who were forecasting stabilization of Venezuelan oil production. And these are the people who knew exactly and whose job it is to follow the investment numbers and the data in the Venezuelan oil industry. They were saying oil production is going to stabilize. Why? Because oil prices are recovering. That's what private sector forecasters also said. You know, the Venezuelan economy is going to follow its normal pattern. This economy, there's always been a positive correlation between oil prices and Venezuelan economic growth. So 2016, oil prices had gone down to $30 a barrel. 2017, 2018, they had gone up to $45, then to $60 a barrel. So everybody was saying, well, if oil prices continue to recover, then the Venezuelan economy is going to stabilize and it's going to recover. That was the consensus forecast in 2017. What changed that was sanctions. So rather than saying, oh, there was a negative trend and that trend was made worse by sanctions, I think that what we would have seen is that we would have seen a V-shaped recession, which would have bottomed out at the moment of low oil prices, which was 2016. And then the Venezuelan economy would have recovered in 2017 and 2018. It would have been a massive economic crisis. I mean, what happened between 2012 and 2016 was massive. But the trend would not have been the same. What we should have expected to occur and what would have occurred if Venezuelan oil production had not started declining as rapidly as it did because of sanctions would have been a recovery of the Venezuelan economy, in which it would have recovered perhaps not all of the lost ground, but it would have recovered some of the lost ground during the period of low oil. So now let me go back to your question on migration. Well, obviously sanctions are contributing to this. Venezuelan migration is primarily, predominantly, if not almost exclusively, economic migration. People are leaving Venezuela because of material living conditions in Venezuela. They're leaving Venezuela overwhelmingly because Venezuelan salaries are extremely low, because there are huge levels of food insecurity, because salaries are not enough to pay for the basic levels of consumption of food for most families, not to talk about other costs of living. That's the driver of Venezuelan migration. The Maduro government is an authoritarian regime. Yes, it is authoritarian. It's a government that has repressed human rights without a doubt. But by and large, the people who are leaving are not escaping the human rights violations, we have to understand what's going on. We have a government that represses protests. It's not a government that's carrying out genocide. Nor is there a physical war going on in Venezuela, like in Syria, where people are escaping from war. They're escaping from bombs. People are escaping from the Venezuelan economy. And to the extent that sanctions have contributed significantly to harming the Venezuelan economy and to generating this economic contraction, then yes, they are a significant contributor to the migrant crisis, to the reason why there are so many Venezuelans abroad and there are so many Venezuelans trying to come into the United States.
Now, we have some encouraging developments in recent months in Venezuela. There's talks between President Maduro and the country's largest opposition coalition, the Unitary Platform or the Plataforma Unitaria. And these are taking place ahead of elections that are supposed to take place sometime next year. And could you unpack for our listeners, who are the major players in terms of these talks and what's on the agenda? You know, many Americans have heard of people like Maduro, of course, and then also Juan Guaido. But who are the players in terms of the opposition forces and what's on the agenda in terms of this potential political compromise?
Okay. So first of all, there are two sets of talks. Now, there are the formal talks that are occurring in Barbados. And in those talks, it's the Maduro government and the Unitary Platform that's represented. And the Unitary Platform is a coalition that's made up of the four largest parties. It's made up by more parties, but it's essentially run by the four parties that were the parties that got most legislators elected in the 2015 elections to the National Assembly. Remember that the opposition not only boycotted the 2018 presidential elections, they also boycotted the 2020 National Assembly elections. So the opposition, as well as the United States, they only recognized the National Assembly that was elected in 2015 as legitimate. And the parties, the opposition parties that were most prominent there, are the parties that run the Unitary Platform. And there's another set of talks which are not public. but which have been occurring between the Maduro government and the U.S. government. And these actually began in early 2022 when three U.S. Administration officials went to Caracas and met with representatives of Maduro for the first time. Now, in something that's worth mentioning is that in 2019, when the U.S. did not recognize Maduro's re-election, the opposition decided that it was going to adopt an interpretation of the Constitution according to which the office of the presidency had become vacant, and therefore the president of the National Assembly, who was Juan Guaido, would be the person who would assume technically the interim presidency. So since 2019, the U.S. government had recognized Juan Guaido as president of Venezuela, even though he had no power in the country. And that had very significant implications, among them that it gave control of the bank accounts of the state-owned oil company and of the external assets. So there's, for example, the U.S. refining company Citgo is actually property of Venezuela, of the Venezuelan government, and that's run by appointees of Juan Guaido. Guaido played a very important role as the leader of the opposition during this period, but he was seen internally as being increasingly ineffective. And in fact, the opposition itself decided that it would disband the interim government at the end of 2022. So Guaido no longer claims to be the president of Venezuela, the legitimate president of Venezuela. The presidency of Venezuela is, in a certain sense, for the opposition and for the United States, pretty much vacant right now, even though there's a de facto ruler. And then you have other political actors that are... Now, Guaido was, of course, from the 2015 National Assembly, and he was a leader of one of those four parties that were the most important ones in the National Assembly. And then you have... But you have another set of actors. You have Maria Corina Machado. Now, Maria Corina Machado, she represents a smaller party, or a party that used to be smaller, that was not that relevant in the 2015 National Assembly. But Maria Corina Machado massively won opposition primaries held by the Unitary Platform in October, at the end of October of this year. And she won with 93% of the vote. So she is the undisputed leader of the Unitary Platform. But there's also a lot of other political parties in Venezuela, many of which are centrist political parties. Now, because they're centrist, the traditional lobby, and by centrist, what I mean is that they are much more, they have been traditionally much more open to negotiation with the Maduro government. Many of them have been opposed to sanctions, and they've been opposed to maximum pressure. They have criticized the Guaido government, particularly, well, there have been several scandals with the Guaido government's management of foreign assets. So these parties that are outside of the Unitary Platform, the mainstream opposition, that is the Unitary Platform, tends to characterize them as being government stooges. And this is something that it happens a lot in these authoritarian regimes. So you have opposition hardliners and opposition moderates. And of course, the moderates are the ones who want to have more engagement with the government. The hardliners will typically characterize the moderates as being in cahoots with the government. And definitely some of that is the case, you know, because the government is obviously also playing its hand at trying to build and help build other groups in the opposition that will contest the power of those that hold a more hardline stance. So these are the groups that have been involved. Now, interestingly, these moderate or centrist parties in the last elections that were held in Venezuela, which were the 2021 elections, they actually got more than half of the opposition vote. So the Unitary Platform, even though it's supposed to be, you know, the main representation of the opposition, it actually represents a minority of the parties that got the vote in the 2021 elections. And there's also a lot of tension between even some governors that were elected on the unitary platform, on the unitary platform's ticket. So for example, the opposition governor of the country's second largest state, which is the state of Zulia, Manuel Rosales, has been very critical of sanctions. And he's been, you know, very open to dialogue with the government, among other things, because it's normal for state governors, when they get into office, to want to have at least a working relationship with the government, because in the end, they have to deliver improvements in public services to their voters. So there's a lot of divisions in the opposition in the sense. And then what we had in October was an announcement that talks had been reinitiated. They had been suspended for nearly a year, and that they had been reinitiated between the unitary platform and the Maduro government. And we had the signing of an agreement. But it's really important to bear in mind that the reason that the signing of that agreement was possible was because the United States, in the separate track negotiation that it had with the Maduro government, decided to reach a deal. The U.S. Started to ease sanctions, and the Maduro government committed to doing two things. One of them is releasing detained Venezuelans and U.S. citizens. So the Venezuelans are essentially political prisoners, and several of them have been released. And then there are also Americans which have been detained. Now, some of them had been released in the past, and there's a commitment, and they have not yet been released, but apparently this is part of the U.S. negotiations. And I say apparently in the sense that, in contrast to the Barbados talks with the opposition, there has been no public statement as to what agreement was reached in the Qatar meetings held in Qatar between the Maduro government and the United States. But there's the understanding that the deal includes the release of Venezuelan political prisoners, of U.S. detainees, and a roadmap to hold a competitive, free, and fair election in 2024. And right now, the main sticking point actually is, it goes back to an issue that we already discussed in the context of the 2018 elections, which are candidate bans. So Maria Corina Machado, who has been elected as the nominee of the unitary platform, is actually banned from holding public office. The government, particularly the Comptroller General's office, which is nominally an independent entity, but it's controlled by Maduro loyalists in Venezuela, it has a charge Machado with falsifying her financial disclosure forms when she was a legislator and not revealing the assets that she has. She denies the allegations, but because of that decision, she's barred from holding office. So what the Venezuelan government announced was that they would open a decision, that they would open a process whereby the Supreme Court will review all of these cases of candidate bans and will effectively decide whether they have been fair. However, just recently, Maria Corina Machado said that she was not going to go to the Supreme Court, that she doesn't recognize the Venezuelan Supreme Court. So it's not very clear where this is going to end up, because there are different players. And Machado, I think, represents probably the most hardline wing of the opposition. In fact, she had actually been critical of Guaido himself, because Guaido, in her view, had not been forceful enough, had not pushed for enough pressure on the Maduro regime. So one sector of the opposition right now is being led by very hardline group. So it's not that clear that there is effectively going to be a compromise, although there is formally a deal both in Barbados and a separate deal between the U.S. and the Maduro government.
Mm. So, you know, it's really interesting just to step back and look at how the impact of the United States on Venezuela, in terms of, you know, how sanctions have distorted the economy, and how the opposition often leans towards the U.S. and when there is that kind of collusion, it incentivizes a kind of maximalist approach by the opposition. So I'm wondering, you know, in a broad sense, what is your perspective on how Washington speaks about Venezuela and Venezuelan politics, and how that impacts U.S. policy towards the country.
Yes. Well, I think that partly we have to view this in a broader regional context. So Chavez was the first president of what became known as the pink tide in Latin American politics. And it was this shift to the left that occurred during the 2000s, where leftist governments started gaining control of the executive branch in generally through elections over most of Latin America. So that pink tide was, I mean, there were discussions in the U.S. as to how to deal with them. And there were different governments because it included some more hardline sectors like Chavez or, well, Cuba, which obviously that didn't come in through elections, but still an important player, Nicaragua under Daniel Ortega. But it also included some more moderate leftists, such as Lula, such as Kirchner, and then Cristina in Argentina, such as the Concertación socialist governments in Chile. So in the U.S. particularly during the Obama administration, tried to tread quite carefully in terms of not alienating many of these governments. And in fact, I think that there was probably a very important moment, which there was a coup attempt in Honduras against a leftist president, Manuel Zelaya. And the U.S. actually took a very firm decision there to denounce that as an unconstitutional attempt to drive them from power. And in fact, ultimately, well, right now in Honduras, the president, Xiomara Castro, is actually the wife of the president who was deposed in that coup attempt. So, but at the end of the 2010s, and particularly after 2017, when Trump came into office, you had another wave, which was like an ebbing of the pink tide. And in many places where left-wing governments had been in power, they had begun to lose power. So you had Bolsonaro in Brazil, and you had Macri in Argentina. So you had a number of conservative governments, and at that moment, what the policy of the Trump administration, which was very much aligned with conservative groups in the region, it began to take sides in this debate in the region, because they saw it as, well, you know, we have the allies, and these right-wing governments are allies, and the left-wing governments are the ones that our foreign policy has to be oriented towards diminishing their power, driving them for power. And there you had a very important turning point in 2019, which was the Bolivian election. The Bolivian elections were elections in which Evo Morales won the first round of the election by a margin that exceeded 10% of points, and which meant that he would not, under constitutional rules, would not have to go to a runoff. Evo Morales is leftist president. The U.S., together with the OAS Secretary General, Luis Almagro, who's been very much an ally of the U.S. in the position, accused the Bolivian government of committing fraud that led to a military insurrection. Evo Morales was ousted from power. One of my pieces of research that I wrote a couple of years ago was on the OAS evidence of backing up the fraud allegations. And we found significant methodological and even numerical errors in the OAS calculations, which undermine their claims of fraud. And this is consistent with what other callers who looked at this issue have found. So generally what happened is that when the U.S. during the Trump administration said, okay, well, it's time to go for the kill here and to get rid of these leftist regimes. And in Bolivia, we do it this way. In Venezuela, we do it this way. That generates backlash in the region. And that That means that the U.S. started playing internal politics in these countries. And of course, it ends up generating huge levels of animosity. So leftist and progressive movements start seeing the U.S. as the enemy and as interventionist and as defending its own interests. In fact, the former president, Donald Trump, actually literally said after leaving office that if he had been blaming the Biden administration for having been too weak on Maduro, he literally said, well, if we had continued doing what I was doing, then that oil would be all ours. So in fact, Trump revealed that U.S. thinking at the time was, and what was driving, and this is also documented in John Bolton's books, actually tells the story of how Trump demanded that in return for U.S. support, Guaido commit to giving American oil companies preferential access to Venezuelan oil. So
basically, what you saw very strongly during the Trump administration was that the U.S. started to take sides in political conflicts in these countries, and Venezuela was an example of. And you also saw that within the opposition. So the U.S. government gave this very strong support to Guaido, and even stepped in at a moment in which the rest of the opposition no longer wanted to maintain Guaido as nominal interim president. The U.S. stepped in and said, no, you have to keep it. The U.S., when the opposition was discussing boycotting, there were candidates who decided that they were going to run for office, that they weren't going to abide by the opposition boycott because they didn't believe that that was a good strategy for facing Maduro. And the U.S. threatened them with sanctions, and in some cases actually did sanction other opposition political parties for not going with the strategy of what was seen as the mainstream opposition at the time and was backed by the U.S. So I think that
we face two problems that the Venezuelan case illustrates. One of them is that if the U.S. starts playing domestic politics, then it's very likely to get burned, and it's very likely to generate significant levels of animosity. And there is that animosity right now within a lot of the Venezuelan opposition. I'm not talking about Maduro, but the opposition with respect to U.S. foreign policy. And then the second question, and I think that the more fundamental one, is when you see a process of a government consolidating authoritarian support, what do you do in order to try to stop that from happening? And I think that what you have to begin from is understanding what is it that's driving the authoritarianism. So why is it that Venezuela is becoming more authoritarian? Now, we tend to think about authoritarianism as being governments led by dictators, and we tend to think about dictators as bad guys. So we tend to think that this is a problem of replacing bad guys by good guys. Evo Morales was accused of being authoritarian, even though he was democratically elected. And when he was ousted from power, what we saw was an unelected interim government that carried out significant violations of human rights and repression of political rights. We're seeing the same thing right now in Peru under a caretaker government that came into office essentially after they drove the leftist elected Mao Pedro Castillo president from office. So I think that this idea that you can address authoritarianism by putting external pressure, economic pressure on these authoritarian regimes, and that somehow is going to alter the political equilibrium, and much more so by pressuring their economies, is something that doesn't make that much sense. I think that what we have to understand is that in the region, there is a long-standing conflict. There are high levels of polarization. There are center-right and right-wing parties, and there are center-left and left-wing parties. And across most countries in the region, politics is split among these groups, just as it is in the U.S. and in many other societies. And the way that you nudge a country and that you help a country recover democratic institutions is not by saying,
let's drive the dictators from power. You tried that in Iraq. You tried that in Libya. You tried that in Afghanistan. You've tried that in a lot of places. And a lot of times you end up with things that are even worse than what you had at the outset. What you have to understand is that where democracy doesn't work, it typically reflects a problem of coexistence between different groups. That groups that are facing off in the fight for power have not found a way to coexist. And if the international community wants to do something to help generate institutions, because what is a democracy? A democracy is a set of agreements that say, we are going to resolve our political conflicts according to these rules. These rules are going to include elections, but they're also going to include constraints on government. Democracies don't elect dictators. Democracies elect presidents, chief executives that are restricted in what they can do by an independent legislative branch, by an independent judiciary. So you have to, and that reflects, and democracy is born out of conflicts that emerge. Actually, democracy emerges in Europe, in countries like France and like the United Kingdom, essentially out of a fight between civil society and monarchical regimes, in which civil society starts imposing limits on the monarchical regimes. So what you have to do is that you have to negotiate those limits, and you have to help negotiate those limits by building institutions that restrain the power of the executive. And if you're able to build those institutions, then you're also going to solve this problem of winner-take-all politics, because it's eminently rational for any leader in a country like Venezuela to say, I am not going to give up power if giving up power means the certainty that I will go to jail and that my people will be politically persecuted. So you have to lower the stakes of power in order to make even elections make sense as a way to resolve political conflicts. And that's where I just think that the U.S. foreign policy with respect to Venezuela or respect to Latin America as a whole is light years away from that type of thinking. They continue to see it as an issue of, there are allies, and our allies are the central right, and there are our enemies, which are the left. And the longer that you continue playing that game, the more hostility that you're going to generate in the region against you.
Yeah. So Venezuela very much seems like a cautionary tale of the excesses of U.S. policy or U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America, and then also at a more global level. We see the overuse of sanctions, the picking of favorites in what is a very divided society, and then the conflation of domestic political rivalries with geopolitics, and this assumption that the emergence of several left-wing governments in a certain part of the world reflects a kind of a domino effect. And it's this kind of Cold War mentality that persists in Latin America, and then also at a global level, because we often hear talk of Venezuela allying with countries like Iran and other rivals and adversaries of the U.S. So it's really unfortunate to see this country, its fate in many ways. Obviously, there's domestic agency and domestic actors, including the Maduro regime and the opposition, bear great responsibility for the conditions in Venezuela today. But the United States has a real hand in all this. And in many ways, the chickens are coming home to roost in the form of this migrant crisis. Well, Dr. Rodriguez, that was very, very informative. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Ari, for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
And that was Dr. Francisco Rodriguez of the University of Denver. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.